Command. Mantle. The caster possesses a minion located in the same dungeon as the caster. The caster's body is left defenseless during this time. Duration? 10 minutes per spellcraft rank. Old Ivan snorted after he was done reading the character sheets.
Dungeon lords are magical up to their balls, Kiss. Us normals can't compare. We're going along with this guard thing because it's a bad idea to tell a dungeon lord to take his ID and shove it. But come on, don't dare tell us that guards will ever be anything more than arrow fodder.
Oh, I see.
Kes caressed her chin as if deep in thought. She glanced at her two pupils, then at old Ivan.
Well, if you say so, since you seem to be more observant than me. Ivan, can you tell me what kind of magic are Alder and Ed using?
Well...
Oblivious to the discussion, Alder closed in on Ed. The bard held his sword over his right shoulder, grasping it with both hands. He and Ed circled each other for a brief instant before Alder lunged forward and launched a diagonal cut aimed at Ed's chest. The dungeon lord adjusted his stance and parried in such a way that he stopped Alder's blade outright. Ed advanced, keeping his edge on Alder's, trying to divert the bard's sword away from his own body while aiming the tip of his blade at Alder's neck. Alder faded backward into the side and brought his sword back to a neutral stance. Ed did the same, but at the last instant threw a blindingly fast vertical slash. Alder reacted by instinct and hefted his sword at an angle to catch Ed's. Right as the blades met, Alder stepped forward and used the impact to make his blade bounce aside, spring around Ed's blade, and trace a horizontal arc aimed at the dungeon lord's helmet. Ed chased the attack, bending his whole body away while bringing his own sword down atop Alder's, but he wasn't fast enough and the bard's sword struck his arm just as his own tapped Alder's shoulder. They both stepped back, acknowledging the strikes. After a couple seconds to regain their breaths, they went at it again, this time with Ed being the aggressor. At no point did they use spells or talents. Kes studied their movements with a neutral expression. She couldn't avoid a surge of pride at seeing how far they'd improved. It seemed to her that only yesterday she'd been forced to watch them stumble. After months and months of daily training, they knew all the basic stances and how to use them to develop a chain of attacks or parries as needed. They knew how to use their legs to power a strike, and their instincts were slowly getting to the point where they'd know if an incoming attack was worth parrying with, say, both hands instead of one. They weren't anywhere close to perfect, and Kes's trained eye picked a dozen tiny openings and errors in their stance that she'd have to drill out of them soon, before they became bad habits. Their reaction times lacked the years and years of experience that would take thinking out of the equation, and their attacks and feints were loudly announced by their body language and positioning. In a fair fight against an expert, they'd lose. But to an untrained eye, the chain of attacks, defenses, and counterattacks was nothing short of impressive. Which was the entire point of Kes bringing the boots to watch.
Well, maybe they aren't using magic right now,
said old Ivan as he crossed his arms.
But just look at his talents, Kes. Lord Edward can't even turn off that magical armor of his. That's not the kind of talent we'll ever have access to. No matter how fair our dungeon lord practices, he simply isn't as easy to hit as a normal human being.
He turned his head, looking to see if the rest of the boots agreed with him. Most of them either did so openly or were nodding to themselves. Kes knew she had them.
So, normal human beings aren't as good warriors as magical ones?
Yeah,
said old Ivan.
That's the ugly truth.
Well, how lucky you are that none of you are normal humans anymore,
Kes said. She let her audience digest her words. Perhaps she'd spent too much time around Alder, then spoke again right as old Ivan opened his mouth.
Let's take a look at your own talents, shall we, Ivan?
She used her instructor voice, so the rest of the boots followed her example. Ivan Ardeen of the Haunt. Human. Experience, 40. Unused, 0. Brawn, 11. Agility, 8. Endurance, 12. Mind, 7. Spirit, 6. Charm, 7. Skills. Brawling. Basic, 3. Craft. Leatherworking. Basic, 10. Talents. Resist disease. Steady hands. Dungeon Minion.
"Quit your damn staring,"
old Ivan said. Among Barova's villagers, it wasn't exactly polite to stare at another person's sheet without good reason. It made people nervous.
"What's your point, Kiss? I'm an honest man. There's nothing unseemly in my stats."
"Look at that dungeon minion talent,"
Kes told him. The man blinked in confusion.
"It's right there on your sheet. Or have you forgotten about it already? I hope not, after you had to recite that dreadfully long pact condition."
The boots winced. Ed's infamous pact conditions were marked in the throne room. Any person wishing to become a member of the Haunt had to recite them in their entirety. And that was no easy feat. Ed called them the Haunt's Terms of Service, but he refused to explain why.
"What about it?"
old Ivan asked.
"It's clearly magical,"
Kes explained.
"It improves your attributes and would add extra spells to your daily limit if you had spell casting. That means there's magic inside you, whether or not you know how to use it. It connects you to the surrounding dungeon and to our dungeon lord. And didn't you say that they are magical up to their balls? Half of that magic is focused on improving the dungeon and its minions."
Kes was now addressing the entire group.
"As Lord Edward unlocks more talents, his minions also grow in power. Remember Kleck and Tulip? The two of them could take on all of you, and they're only a Batblin and a spider. Listen, bards have a concept called the IC line that talks about adventurers and normal people. Adventurers take a lot of risks, so they rake in hundreds of experience points. So far, you've taken few risks, and that has been the smarter choice. But with my training and the mantle's magic, you can take bigger chances and survive. Imagine what you'd become with enough experience points and enough training. Guard duty would only be the beginning."
"What does the IC stand for?"
someone asked.
"Don't worry about it,"
Kes said, waving her hand. She realized she had their full attention. A part of her understood why Alder acted the way he acted. Motivation was a powerful tool. And perhaps all drill sergeants needed to love the spotlight in order to do what they did best.
"Think, people. Imagine going to sleep without being terrified of some creature breaking into your home and devouring your family. For once, the monsters under the bed may be scared of you. Sure, you'll never be invincible. No mortal is. But you'll at least have a fighting chance. That's how Lord Edward feels every day. Imagine charging at a spider queen and winning. Forget the riches and the magic. You know what real power is? It's knowing that, no matter how stacked the odds are against you, you'll always have a fighting chance."
Kes left out the darker side of that implication, because they didn't need to know. Not yet. Ed's mantle had been bought over a pact with the dark god Murmur. The Dungeon Lord's minions, by the nature of their pact with him, benefited from Ed's power, but also shared the risk that they could be corrupted by it as well. Whatever became of Ed in the years to come, the Haunt and its inhabitants would follow. Kostel had a greedy glint in her eyes.
"That's a pretty picture you paint, Kes."
"Bah! Even if she's right, minions are still arrow fodder,"
Razvan pointed out. He and old Ivan shared a nod.
"You're right. Most dungeon lords use their minions that way,"
Kes said.
"Most dungeon lords are now dead. Look behind me. Would someone planning to hide behind his minions come to train here, morning after morning, for hours on end? The Haunt has survived this long, Razvan, because we don't do what got others killed. And that's the final lesson I'll teach you today. The Haunt, this thing we're building, is more than a structure carved out of rock and ley lines. It's more than a dungeon as well. The Haunt is something that will last, and you're a part of it. But it's a responsibility too. I know you don't understand yet. You volunteered for personal reasons, after all. It's all right. Someday it'll make sense. In the meantime, keep thinking I've gone a little insane. What I want from you is to pretend that you get it. I need you to yell, 'Yes, sir,' and then come back tomorrow to learn the best ways to disembowel any son of a bitch that dares threaten your home."
"Yes, sir!"
her nine boots yelled in unison. Kes flicked away a strand of hazelnut hair caked in sweat,
Where the hell did that come from?
There are two ways to train a mule,
Rhea told her.
Carrot and stick. I liked to use the stick. You're waving the promise of a carrot at them and hoping they're hungry. But be careful, Boot. Here, in the basement of your mind, it looks like you believe your own words more than you'd like to admit. That's dandy for a draftee, but very dangerous for a professional soldier.
Fuck off, Sarge. The minion talent gives one extra rank to charm. Demagoguery. That's all it is. Class dismissed,
she said aloud. She watched them leave. They were sweaty and barely able to stand, and they stole curious glances her way when they thought she wasn't looking. Young Ivan pointed to his temple and swirled his finger. Rasvan laughed. Kostel sneered.
Green,
Kes whispered. Your drill sergeant skill has increased by one rank. Upon reaching advanced status, your students will be able to purchase improved rank military talents you teach them even if they don't fulfill the skill requirements. Chapter 7. Time to Strike Back. Ed woke to a dull noise in the dark. Still in the throes of his dream, he tossed the covers of his bed aside and grabbed the crystal vial he kept on a stand. A feeling of cold doom crept up his arm like an infection.
Oh, he said, it's just you.
He returned the holy water vial to the stand, and the doom evaporated. The old drone regarded him with eyes as big and round as dishes. Half his imp-like face was covered in coarse white whiskers, and the rest was wrinkled. The drone told him, showing Ed the tip of a snake-like tongue.
Someone's at the door?
Ed almost went back to sleep. To be honest with himself, he'd half expected a different visitor. But the boatman had kept his promise. He hadn't returned since their last encounter, and that had been months ago. Ed should have considered that a victory, but Charon's absence made him nervous.
One second.
He jumped out of the bed and waved his hand in front of the magical torch by the wall. It turned on and bathed the bedchamber in warm purple light. The floor tiles were warm thanks to the haunt's heating system. Ed hurried to a dress stand while the drone watched with a judgmental frown at his sluggishness. At first, Ed hadn't even considered keeping a drone inside his chambers while he slept. He had enough alarm spells in place anyway, and drones weren't exactly quiet and respectful of people's rest. Kes had convinced him to try it by pointing out that alarms could be dispelled, and a drone at least could scream if someone entered the room uninvited.
It's just the smart thing to do,
she had told him.
What happens to the rest of us if you choke on a grape when no one is around?
He threw on a comfy green tunic and slipped into his Thieves Guild boots while tightening the guild's utility belt around his waist.
Have them come in,
he told the drone after making sure the wrappings covering his left hand were in place. The old creature scoffed and disappeared into the antechamber. For the life of him, Ed couldn't guess at what rules governed the age and physical features of a drone. For all he knew, it was completely random. This one had already been like this when he'd summoned it for the first time. It was as if the creature had been born to be a butler. The door to his chambers opened, and he heard unsteady footsteps. Ed hurried to the antechamber, waving magical torches on as he went along. The purple light illuminated a ragged batblin dressed in a doublet with the haunt's laser shark sewn by its lapel. He was holding a scruffy hat in his hands, turning it around nervously.
My lord,
the batblin squeaked.
Terribly sorry for waking you up, my lord, but you said to do it if it was important.
Ed frowned. It bothered him that the batblin could be afraid of angering him simply for following his orders.
Terribly sorry,
the batblin exclaimed, seeing Ed's expression. Ed noted the critter's split ear and the burnt patch of fur poking out of the doublet's neck.
Drusp, is it not? Don't be afraid. You only followed my instructions. Tell me, what happened?
Quack and tulip, sir,
Drusp said. Ed's heart froze mid-beat.
They've returned, sir, and are asking for you. I told them you were sleeping, but they insisted. Said you'd want to hear their report at once.
Ed let out the breath he had been holding.
They're alive.
For a resourceful Batblin like Kleck, a scouting job wasn't as dangerous as it was for others, but there was always the chance that something could go wrong. "I'll meet them in the war room," he said, "and wake the others. Have them catch up with us there." He hurried to grab his green cape from the hangar next to the door while Druzd grimaced and looked back at the darkness of the corridor outside.
"Even the witch? She's cranky when woken, sir. Scary."
Ed was already out into the corridor, hurrying for the stairs.
"You're right. Send a few drones first, just in case she wakes up with a mood."
Druzd gulped, then his footsteps receded as he rushed for the other chambers. The fireplace crackled in the war room, the flames waving under the supernatural light of the torches. Feverish concentration permeated the air. Ed hunched over a parchment map of Constantina and its surroundings, studying a pair of red pins set between Hoya and the ruins of Barova. The map was spread on a mahogany table reinforced with bronze and carved with grotesque figures at the legs and edges. Kleck had climbed atop the table and was carefully pinpointing the exact location of Uraz's dungeon, while Tulip hung from the ceiling by a strand of web.
"Where's Levy?"
Alder said, forcing down a yawn. He was reclined on a mahogany chair which had a back taller than anyone present and a skull engraved at its top.
"She's the only one missing."
Cass had her back against one tapestry that adorned the walls, while Kaga sat on the floor next to the fireplace, enjoying the warmth on his bare back. There was the faint noise of a commotion upstairs. Ed vaguely sensed that a few of his drones had been unsummoned.
"She just woke up," he said.
A few minutes later, the two drones by the doors pushed them open, and a disheveled witch strolled into the room.
"Fine, fine, I'm here. This better be important. My beauty sleep is ruined."
She rubbed her eyes with her sleeve and took notice of everyone in the room.
"Kleck? When did you come back?"
"Just now. Barely completed by quested time,"
Kleck told her. Kleck looked very different from the malnourished Batblin that had originally joined Ed and the others. A Kufdar-made serrated dagger hung from a black sheath at his side, and his fur was shiny and thick. He was bulkier than Druzd now and approaching his 10th rank in endurance. Ed could have sworn the Batblin had even grown an inch or two. Kess's training, paired with a healthy diet, had done wonders for Kleck. And he was much more confident nowadays.
"You don't need beauty sleep, Levy," he told her.
Levy half-snorted and waved her arm at him.
"You flatterer. It won't help you if you ruined my sleep for nothing, mind you."
She plopped down on the nearest chair.
"Thank you all for coming," Ed said. "Time is short, though, so... Kess, you mind?"
The Marshal stepped forward, the very image of Marshal Gravitas.
"I'll be brief. The Haunt's survival in Stravos caught the attention of a minor group of Lothian dungeon lords down on their luck. They came here testing their fortunes and have been waging a campaign against the Inquisition's heroes for a few months, with little success. Their idiocy brought us some breathing space and a chance at finding the hero's weakness. The Haunt's command..."
"That's us,"
whispered Alder, smiling while elbowing Kaga.
"I'm a commander now."
"The Haunt's command,"
Kess went on,
"gave our agents Kleck and Tulip the quest. Find a witness of heroic attack. They've been keeping an eye on the activity of Dungeon Lord Uraz in the region, at great risk to themselves. They completed their quest today. Uraz is gone, but one of his underlings survived the destruction of the dungeon."
She rummaged through the table, found a parchment, and held it up for everyone to see. It was the drawing of a coffin that matched Kleck's vague description.
"We believe it to be a vampire. Although we don't have intelligence reports to confirm it, we suspect he was Uraz's second in command and fought the heroes along with his dungeon lord in the final battle. After his body was destroyed, he returned to his coffin to regenerate, where he was captured by the Inquisition, which arrived after the heroes left the area."
"Sorry for butting in, Kiss,"
Alder said,
"but I thought vampires turned to dust after being destroyed."
Levy clapped with delight.
"A nightshade vampire? I have always wanted to meet one."
She stood and grabbed the coffin drawing from Kess's hands.
"Nightshade is a vampire breed native to Lothia, so it's no surprise that Alder hasn't heard of them. They are much cooler than those lame Heligian marauders, and more passionate than those dry Sterevulzi old bloods."
You sure sound like you know a lot about these guys, despite never having met one,
Alder told her.
Well, yes, I've read a lot about them.
Levy's lip trembled and her cheeks turned bright red.
In research tomes, I mean. For research.
Right.
The witch hurried to change the subject.
Nightshades are the most resilient vampires around. An ancient one is almost impossible to kill. They just keep coming back. Somewhere along their progression tree, they can unlock a talent that allows them to turn to mist if they're slain, and they return to their coffin instead of dying. I think it's called Mist Heart or something like that.
Sort of like a lich's phylactery? Ed asked. That would be a useful talent to have, although having to protect a coffin was much harder than hiding a small trinket. Interesting. He made a mental note of asking Levy the specifics of the other vampire breeds later.
I'm more familiar with Old Bloods, Kaga shared. A distant branch of my family used to hunt them a long time ago. Vampire hunters! Those were the days.
Thanks for the intel, Levy,
Kes said, snatching back control of the conversation.
Yoraz's vampire is in the hands of the Inquisition. They're bringing his coffin to Undercity to execute him. Probably as a show of force, to intimidate the rebellion.
Haligis had conquered Starevos more than a decade ago, and small rebel groups still sprang up here and there. Nikolai's group had been one of those. It was all part of a complicated plan by Murmur to buy his favorite kingdom, Lotia, enough time to rebuild its army so it could challenge Haligis' supremacy again. Ed knew that the presence of Lotian dungeon lords in Starevos meant that Murmur's plan was working.
I want that vampire, Ed said. The chance that he knows something about the heroes we don't is too big to pass up.
Alder gave him an alarmed look.
You want us to attack an inquisitorial convoy? That's suicide! The losses will be substantial,
Kaga agreed.
But if the dungeon lord orders us to fight, my Kuftar will honor our pact with him.
Me too, said Kleck. I ain't afraid.
You should be,
Tulip admonished.
But as Queen Laurel's representative in this meeting, I can assure you the Horned Spiders shall uphold our pact with Lord Wraith.
Thanks, everyone, Ed said.
He couldn't help but feel touched at their loyalty.
But we are not going to fight them. We will steal that damn coffin right out from under their noses.
He straightened his back and held the gaze of everyone in the room.
This stalemate has gone on long enough, people. I love turtling inside my base as much as anyone, but every dungeon lord that tried that before is dead. The heroes respawn. We don't. The haunt cannot hide forever, and I don't know about you, but I'm tired of being on the defensive.
He had another reason for wanting to take that coffin. Back on Earth, Ed had been part of the ranks of gamers that the militant church used to hunt dungeon lords. He had a perspective that no other dungeon lord had, but he'd never seen the heroes in the flesh. After he gathered enough information about them, he knew he could put the mystery together. He could figure out how to win.
What, Lands Ed, you're serious?
Levy muttered. She smoothed a wrinkle in her tunic.
No one here is that good at stealth. Perhaps if we send word to Karmic and the Thieves Guild, we can have a team waiting for the Inquisitors when they enter Undercity.
That won't work,
Kes said.
Kleck and Tulip left for the haunt as soon as the Inquisitors headed for Undercity.
She pointed to the location of Yuraz's dungeon on the map and traced the route through the forest until it reached the haunt.
Unlike spiders and batblends, horses aren't good at nighttime riding. So the Inquisitors are camping somewhere around here.
She traced a circle with her finger over an area of a secondary road that led to Undercity.
And we'll arrive at the main road early in the morning. Now, if I were in charge of the convoy, I'd have an escort team ready to meet me in the main road to reinforce my approach. Catching them after they enter the main road is out of the question. Attempting the steal in Undercity is even worse. If we're doing this, it has to be tonight.
Wetlands,
Levy said, more to herself than anyone else.
I guess we are doing this.
Don't worry, Ed assured her. I have a plan. We have an hour to set everything up. Kaga, gather your team and the Hell Chicken mounts. Alder, wake Yorje and Andrina and have them come here. Levy, get some rest. You're going to raise the dead tonight. Kleck, Tulip, Tell the raiders it's time for their first mission. Kes, you're with me. Part of him was exultant. Despite the late hour, he was wide awake. Finally, he had the chance he had been waiting for. His friends accepted his instructions and hurried to set them in motion. His chest beamed with pride. They were no longer a terrified bunch with no idea what they were doing. Despite all the horror of the mind brood and all the pain that Nikolai had caused, those experiences had taught them all something important. They could defend themselves and win. They could strike back. Hell, they could even punch first. Ed's eyes flashed green as he focused on the link between himself and his minions. This power was an extension of the way the mantle worked, a neat little detail he had discovered after raising his dungeon skills high enough. He brought up an empty sheet and focused his will to add blazing green letters to it. When he was done, he sent the new sheet out through the connection created by the pact between Dungeon Lord and Minion. An announcement appeared in front of him. It was based on his handiwork, but the finer details, like the bonuses and the rewards, came from some unknown source. He knew that every minion was seeing the same screen. It read, "A new dungeon mission is active. Raid the Inquisitorial Convoy. Time sensitive. Description: A group of Inquisitors is traveling to Undercity with a coffin containing a vampire that witnessed the heroes in action. Win condition: Deliver the coffin safely into the haunt. Reward: Experience. Recruitment chance. Vampire Lieutenant. Plunder wagons. Bonus: Succeed without killing anybody. Bonus: Keep your presence hidden from the Inquisitors. Defeat condition: The coffin is destroyed. The convoy reaches the main road. The haunt's agents are killed or captured."
"So, this is one of those quest things that has everyone so excited?"
Andrina asked as she turned the phantasmal screen around her hand.
"Interesting. I never would have guessed that the fastest way to get someone to do what you want is to call it a quest. Perhaps I'll task my apprentices with quests instead of odd jobs."
Ed grinned. "Go ahead. I have yet to hear someone complain about a stuffed quest list." The herbalist had arrived shortly after Alder and the others left the war room. Despite the late hour, she seemed as cheerful as always. She was used to people waking her up in the middle of the night. Her curly hair was gathered in a messy bun, and she was dressed in a function-over-form brown dress and an old woolen jacket. She had locks of strange plants hanging from her belt, the way an artisan may carry a hammer, as well as a tin flask filled with her personal brew.
"I bet it won't be the same unless it's a dungeon lord's quest," said Yorjay, suppressing a yawn.
He was dressed only in his trousers, boots, and a furred coat that looked suspiciously like a bear pelt.
"Gives it legitimacy, you know?"
Governor Brett coughed. He was wearing woolen pajamas.
"Am I correct in assuming I can share the rewards of this quest without actually entering combat? No offense intended, your fiendishness, but I doubt I'd make a useful warrior," he said as he patted his belly and gave Ed a meaningful look.
So far, Ed had only issued a few personal quests here and there. The Kufdars had Find a Way to Tame Hell Chicken Mounts as a quest, for example. It was the first time he had issued a dungeon-sized quest, so in a way, he was treading new ground.
"I think that everyone who chips in gets a share of the rewards. At least, that's how it's worked before."
"Excellent."
Brett's eyes glinted with greed.
"Then, how may I be of service, Lord Edward?"
"If we succeed, we're going to have a vampire inside the haunt," Ed said. "I don't know if he'll want to work with us, or if we'll want to work with him, so we need to make sure security is up to par. Get a hold of Zachary and figure out ways we can protect the place in case the vampire tries to escape. Traps, spells, guard protocols, containment rooms, anything you can think of. And don't worry about coming up with a silly idea. We'll figure out what is feasible and what isn't when we return."
"I understand," Brett said. "This task shall be accomplished to your utmost satisfaction, my lord. You can count on it. I'll come up with clever new policies that not even an elder vampire could outsmart."
He saluted Ed and stood up to leave. On his way out, he reached for a tray by the table and grabbed a clay mug filled with a warm, bitter tea Andrina had brewed to invigorate them for the night. Ed bit his lip. Brett, despite his personality, was a fairly competent governor.
if one ignored his tendency to fatten his own pockets on the down low, he'd come up with a good idea or two. Ed would have wanted to do it himself, but there was no time.
"There goes his pompousness,"
Yorjay said after the governor had left.
"I wonder how he'll try to sneak himself into extra authority this time."
"The same way he always does,"
Kes said, looking up from the pile of parchments with checklists, map sketches, and theory crafting about the Inquisitor's talent choices.
"He'll want to create a committee and name himself president."
"I expect more creativity from him," Ed said. He turned to Yorjay. "So, it looks like we'll need to test our railway out a bit earlier." Yorjay closed his eyes as if Ed had punched him in the gut.
"I was hoping you wouldn't say that, Ed. I hate showing off a project before it's ready."
"Sorry, I know. I wouldn't ask if it weren't important."
"Of course. I hope you have a way of slowing down the cart, since I haven't added the brakes yet."
Kes looked up from her papers again.
"Railway?"
she asked.
"Dungeon project. Underground railway,"
Yorjay explained.
"The railway is a method of transporting goods between the Haunt and Undercity without having to rely on horses. Ed thought of it and asked our dwarf friend Oscar to help with the schematics. Seems like dwarfs have been using railways in their mines for a long time."
A good chunk of the Haunt's income came from smuggling booze and other items into Undercity, but the logistics of moving the product to the city was a pain. The horned spiders absolutely refused to be used as beasts of burden. Horses had a hard time traversing Hoya's hidden roads, and it took a while for Ed's drones to push the carts around. When it was completed, a railway between Hoya and Undercity would solve that problem. Ed also planned to exploit it as much as he could, beginning tonight.
"How does that help us now?"
Kes wondered.
"We need to get the coffin away from the Inquisition's reach," Ed told her. "Hauling it on our backs and hopping away won't work, so the railway is our best shot."
It would be dangerous. For the plan to work, Ed's group would need to raise hell to distract the Inquisitors. A lot could go wrong, which made getting the plan right from the get-go even more important. Ed could see Kes thinking it over. Recently, before she and Ed had had time to know each other, the avian would have refused to take such a risk. That was how a mercenary survived, by choosing when to turn tail and fuck off.
"Very well,"
was all the marshal said tonight, before going back to her papers.
"I'll need to scan the prototype," Ed told Yorjay, "to add it to my Evil Eye's list of dungeon rooms."
"Of course. I'll assemble it as fast as I can,"
the blacksmith said. Then he rose.
"You really should figure out a way to slow down the cart, though."
As he headed to leave, Kes handed him a long parchment.
"Give this to the forge helpers. Have someone read it to them. It's a list of all the supplies we'll need. Have them sent to the middle of the market and we'll handle it from there."
"Got it, Kes."
The drones opened the door for the blacksmith and closed it after he'd left. Ed sipped Andrina's tea to clear his mind. It was bitter and herbalish. Nothing at all like coffee, which was a shame. Next on the list was... He shifted in his seat to face Andrina.
"You want potions?"
the herbalist said.
"I want potions," Ed confirmed. "What do we have in store?"
"Vitality potions have the longest shelf life, so there are 3 barrels ready. Agility potions take a while to make, but we have a barrel left over from the spiderlings. I have a few bottles of staunch elixir. It helps stop blood loss."
She gave him a quick rundown of the rest. Water-breathing drafts, cold-resistance flasks, and the rest were basic medical supplies and stimulants.
"We'll take all the staunches and have your assistants fill flasks with vitality for everyone," Ed said. "Also, prepare some raw meat infused with agility and this tea, for good measure," he said as he held up his mug.
"Hell, now that I think of it, can you mix it with our vitality too?"
"You're just begging to have your heart explode out of your chest at 30, aren't you?"
Andrina said, pursing her lips.
"Well, not my place to tell a grown man how he should treat his kidneys. Or liver. Or pancreas. You want a potion combo, you'll get a potion combo. Just don't drink more than the dose I'll put in the flask or, you know."
She pointed at Ed's chest and made a bursting motion.
"I'll sign you a waiver if you want,"
Ed told the herbalist with a nervous chuckle. He was sure she was exaggerating the heart explosion part.
Right?
Won't be necessary.
Andrina jumps to her feet and rubbed her hands together.
I'll have your potions delivered at the market in half an hour, Ed.
Thanks, Andrina. After she left, the only ones remaining were he and Kes. The sand in the hourglass on a corner of the table was about half done. Time to put on our weapons and armor, Ed told the marshal.
Have the drones bring them here,
she said. She held her stack of papers in front of Ed.
Let's go back over the plan, Ed. There won't be any do-overs once we piss off the Inquisitors. So, start from the beginning.
Ed glanced at the avian handwriting, some kind of cuneiform language he couldn't understand.
Very well. The plan goes off in stages. First, I'll need time to create a temporary dungeon.
The market bristled with nervous energy. The night was cloudy, with the moon nowhere to be seen. Had he been superstitious, he'd have thought it a good omen. It'd be easy to hide his forces in the dark. Most of them had some variant of night vision. The spider riders had their echolocation, and the Kuffdar had an acute sense of smell. If all else failed, Ed's drones could see in total darkness and would guide anyone who got lost. Eye Gouger and the rest of the mounts were tied to a pole at the end of the market, being watched by a nervous young Kuffdar. The hell chickens squeaked from their half-open beaks, and their red eyes followed Ed's movements. A line had formed in front of Kes and Levy, who had appropriated a couple of wooden stalls to set up shop and distribute runes, bows, and ammunition with the help of a group of Batblins. The spider warriors rested by a corner while their Batblin riders fumbled to strap their chairs and stirrups to the spiders' torsos. Kaga's monster hunters were giving their weapons one last look over before the trip. Their shaggy tails wagged, and their cackles pierced the night like the war cry of anxious predators. Ed glanced at the sky again. The speed at which the haunt had mobilized was nothing short of astounding. It was as if the entire population shared the nervous energy that had been nestling inside himself the last couple of months. Eager to spring to action, so when the time had arrived, it would find them ready.
Tonight's gonna go straight into my chronicle, you know,
Alder said as he caught sight of Ed and strolled over. The bard had changed his colorful attire for the black leather armor of the Thieves Guild, with a sturdy brown shirt underneath and his duelist longsword hanging from a tight belt. Ed was dressed in the same way, with his green cape hugging his shoulders and swaying with the breeze.
Is that so? You should let me have a look someday, Ed said, only half-jokingly.
Alder's A Most Impartial Chronicle of the Haunt and Its Rise to Power was the bard's self-proclaimed masterpiece. According to him, once it was finished, it'd tell the entire history of the haunt since its beginnings, from the perspective of an eyewitness. Himself. As far as Alder knew, no other modern bard had attempted such a feat, mostly because dungeon lords, as a rule of thumb, reacted poorly to anything short of devoted adulation. Ed, though, had already suspected that Heligian historians wouldn't consider him worthy of praise, so he figured he may as well trust Alder to tell an impartial-ish version of their lives. Perhaps someone out there, a long time from now, would find them. Perhaps they'd even believe a word or two.
No way, Alder said, grinning. Friendships get strained when one part sees what the other thinks of them.
Ed mirrored the bard's smile.
I'm sure you're overreacting. If it's the Haunt's honest chronicle, then I have nothing to fear.
It was a conversation they'd had a couple times already, and it had become sort of an inside joke between them.
It's the honest part that people have an issue with. They all say they have nothing to hide, but when the truth disagrees with them, suddenly their critique is expressed by hanging the bard and setting him on fire unless he changes his tune. That's why Elytra stopped bothering with chronicling dungeon lords a long time ago. Being impartial is very hard with a noose around your neck and smoke tickling your toes.
Perhaps some dungeon lords had a noose around their necks, too, Ed said. Maybe we haven't heard of them only because it's Heligian bards sharing their stories.
Alder scratched his chin.
I've often wondered why Lothia has no bards of their own. Everyone I know is an Elytra student.
You want me to give you a quest to investigate more? Ed told him. Could be interesting to find out why.
How about we finish this one first? It looks like our brave troops are almost ready.
Right.
Ed passed a hand through his hair and took a deep breath of chilly air. He was less troubled now, his hands steadier,
as if his mind had needed a bit of a distraction to fully focus on tonight's mission. Talking with Alder had that effect on him. The bard lived his life with his head in the clouds, and often a short visit was relaxing. He headed for the middle of the market. Almost everyone was ready and accounted for. Most eyes fell on him, as if they expected him to say something. His throat had gone dry.
"I won't lie and say that tonight will be easy."
A couple of the Batblin riders close to Kleck exchanged worried glances.
"Great start, asshole. Just tell them you're afraid of everything, and their mothers are going to be brutally fucking murdered."
He fought back the impulse to back down and let Kes handle the speech.
"But we are ready for this. We've trained, and we've got the element of surprise on our side. Stick to the plan, and all will be well."
Yeah!
Kleck cheered, and a few Batblins imitated him. The spiders were silent. Speeches were not their thing at all. One of the monster hunters cracked his knuckles and patted Levy on the back, almost sending the witch sprawling.
"At least I can count on the Kuftar to keep the morale high," Ed thought.
As long as they knew they got to fight something, the Kuftar were happy. Alder stepped up next to Ed right as he was about to order everyone to move out.
"Remember, people, tonight you represent the Haunt. Your victory is its victory, as your defeat would be its shame. Fight bravely, O warriors. Our dungeon lord will be right in the thick of the battle with us, so make sure that when he turns your way, all he sees is a proud minion of the Haunt. And if you find yourself giving in to fear, just think of all the experience points we're sure to rake in."
He drew his sword and hefted it upward, as if to stab the sky. To Ed's surprise, the Kuftar and Kes imitated the gesture. Levy and the Batblins watched on, looking as confused as he felt.
"Nice speech," Ed whispered at Alder. "Where did it come from?"
The bard sighed with satisfaction.
"The Canticle of Dawn by Melchiades. Numerios the Pure addresses his troops. Closing verse, paraphrased, abridged."
He chuckled to himself as he walked away. Kes had everyone take their places in the marching formation. Dungeon commanders were at the center, with the Kuftars as rear guard. Spider riders were in the front, flanked by Laurel's spider warriors, with spiderling scouts already tracking the Inquisitor's camp. As Ed hurried to his spot in the middle of the formation, next to Kes and Levy, he saw movement from the corner of his eye. Yorche hurried out of the dungeon's entrance. A group of four Forge Batblins chased after him, carrying together some kind of wooden display.
"One moment!"
Yorche called as he reached Ed's group. Sweat drenched his forehead.
"Sorry for the delay. Was too sleepy earlier to realize you may want this."
His assistants caught up to him, and he gestured at Ed to approach as he flicked the brass latch of the display and pushed the top open to reveal its contents.
"Finished it last week, I did. Brett wanted to make a big show of giving it to you, but I figured you'd appreciate it more right now."
Several plate armor parts rested on a violet pillow. A shiver ran through Ed's spine. He'd almost forgotten all about it. The last time he'd seen that steel, it had been a charred mess taken from the remains of Nikolai while Ed's drones fanned the flames. Yorche, perhaps acting out a Sterevosi blacksmith's own ancient traditions, had transformed the steel of Ed's fallen enemy into an armor fitting of a dungeon lord. The result went beyond Ed's expectations. The breastplate was one large piece of metal etched with gothic patterns that combined flowery geometric shapes with open-mawed skulls and thorny roots. The etchings were silver and glinted under the light of the torches, but the rest of the armor was black as night, with waves of softer darks undulating across its surface, as if invisible flames engulfed the armor. Ed found it both beautiful and cruel. A gift and a warning.
"There wasn't enough salvageable steel left to make a full plate set,"
Yorche explained over Ed's shoulder as he took in the details of the rest of the armor.
"But we can add those extra pieces later."
The helmet was a singular, visorless piece with an opening shaped like a Y that left the eyes, nose, and mouth exposed. Its lines were sharp and angular, resembling the threatening frown of some imposing giant. One gauntlet had spiderweb etching across its surface, and the hand had been shaped as a vaguely spider-like head, with steel points at the knuckles resembling fangs. The other was ridged, bent, and interconnected, taking the shape of one big skeletal arm and hand. The greaves matched the gauntlets.
"This is incredible," Ed whispered. "You outdid yourself, Yorjay."
"That I did. That I did. But I cannot take all the credit. Most of those etchings aren't mine. Your drones added them as soon as I finished the breastplate. But don't worry. I looked, and there isn't a single obscenity. That I could find. I had no idea they could work metal, to be honest, so it took me by surprise."
"Neither did I," Ed said. He brushed the artwork with his hand. Even his inexpert fingers could sense the quality of Yorjay's craftsmanship.
"Is it enchanted?" "Not yet, but it can be. You'll need to hire an expert, though, because that's beyond my talent tree. In the meantime, your pledge of armor works, right?"
Ed grabbed the helmet with both hands and lifted it, feeling its weight. Almost absently, he summoned a group of drones to help him don the armor.
"Thank you, Yorjay. I'm in your debt," he said, as the drones grabbed the armor and eased Ed into it.
"Ah, just stay alive out there,"
the blacksmith said with a proud little smile.
"I'll go back to sleep, so you all make sure to be back when I wake up."
"Glad to try," Ed thought.
"Finally,"
said Levy as the drones hurried to tighten the straps of Ed's greaves while he slipped back into his cape and worked the leather fasteners.
"It was about time you donned the proper Dungeon Lord outfit."
Like Levy, most of his retinue stared at the new armor. Ed could hear the whispers. What were they saying? Perhaps he looked ridiculous in the damn thing. Alita's tits. He was a programmer, not some kind of feudal warlord.
"Is that still true, though?"
He caught Kess's gaze. The avian had a pensive frown on her face. When she realized Ed was looking her way, she turned away and whispered something to herself. Seems like Lord Wraith found his armor. They grow so fast, eh, Rhea? It sounded like she said. Ed couldn't make sense of it.
"What's so important about proper attire?"
Alder asked Levy.
"Well, we couldn't have him running around wearing the same rags as a common thief,"
Levy said petulantly.
"Might give people the wrong idea."
"The wrong idea?"
Alder lifted an eyebrow. He was wearing those exact thief rags. So was she, at that. No use for pretty dresses out in the middle of a battle.
"Oh, yes,"
Levy said, ignoring Alder's tone.
"It could have made people think that Dungeon Lord Edward Wright was only a mere mortal, a human who dies just as easily as any other."
"But I do die as easily as any other."
"That's why it is the wrong idea. There's no need for them to know that."
Ed barked a laugh, set his hood over his head, and turned on his evil eye.
"You know what? You may be right,"
he told the witch. The eldritch light bathed the armor and made the flames ebb and flow, creating the illusion that he was some nightmarish monster lurking in the dark. When the Haunt's forces left to intercept the Inquisitors, a dungeon lord that looked the part led them. Chapter 8. Black Magic Incoming. Gallio woke in the candle firelight of his tent to the overbearing suspicion that something dreadful was headed his way. For an instant, he lingered between nightmare and wakefulness, unsure of which was which, as if his cramped travel tent that smelled of garlic and old incense were too good to be true. As if the only possible reality had to be those dark tunnels of his dream, expanding forever, carrying unending hordes of red-eyed creatures with oily carapaces and razor-sharp teeth toward the unsuspecting village of Barova. Gallio still thought he could hear the lingering ring of the Dungeon Lord's laughter as his creatures burst forth from the skulls of Ione and Vasile and Kess and Alvedra. His skin shivered with the phantom pain of fangs piercing him all around, and his body shook as he struggled against a dozen inhuman arms holding him down while the Dungeon Lord skittered to a stop in front of him and extended his dozen arms to allow a sea of insects to slither out of his body and crawl their way toward Gallio and inside him, where they began to feed. His hand fumbled around until he found the small brass flask next to his bedroll. He took deep breaths and emptied his mind until the memory of the nightmare faded until all that remained was the beating of his heart and the chirping of insects outside. Then he took a long drink of his tea, allowing the milky liquid to sweep down his throat. According to the priest that made it for him, the concoction was supposed to keep the nightmares at bay. But for the effect it had, or lack of it, Gallio suspected that the priest was pocketing his quarter aureuses instead. Gallio furrowed his brow. Deception among the members of the militant church carried a heavy penalty, but it wasn't as if Gallio could report the priest or punish him in any way. After all, he couldn't explain his dreams to the Inquisition without telling them of the Battle of Barova, of the Mind Brood, and of Ione and the Dungeon Lord Edward Wright. The penalty for hiding a Mind Brood's existence from the Inquisition was harsher and more thorough than deception. But that wasn't what worried Gallio. Even if the Mind Brood was long dead, even if all danger had been extinguished as Barova burned, the Inquisition would still drown the entire region in flames to protect the rest of the world from the slightest risk of infection. Brutal, without a doubt. Also, without a doubt in his mind, the right thing to do. Sephar's bane had almost destroyed civilization. Any measure was justified, no matter how cruel, as long as it ensured that the bane would never come again. What was a lone village when weighed against civilization's survival? But Barova's mind brood had been a fluke, merely the fruit of a lone egg bought by Ione's treachery. The ranger had planned to force the Inquisition to torch the region to justify a rebellion against Heligian rule in Sturevos. Gallio couldn't murder the people he'd lived among and grown to love because of a lone man's madness. That was his secret sin. The militant dogma warned against cultivating too much empathy, because the militant church's sacred duty was to do the things that no one else dared to, no matter how necessary. Even if it meant fostering resentment among the common folk, the good of the majority was more important. Gallio knew this. It had been drilled into the core of his soul since he'd first set foot on a militant temple, just one scrawny kid among thousands of new arrivals, all volunteered by their noble families vying for the honor of having their child pass the harsh trials that would welcome them into Haligi's finest. What would his house think of him tonight? Gallio had lost contact with them after his exile into Sturevos. Even now that Alita had accepted him back into her ranks, he hadn't sent even a single letter. And neither had they. Perhaps, because deep down, he knew that broken honor could be mended. But the scars never faded.
"These dreams are Alita's punishment for my weakness," Gallio surmised.
He set the flask away from him with a frown of contempt. He often thought that his nightmares carried a kind of poetic justice. After all, Alita's blessing upon her inquisitors protected their minds from breaking under the horrors of carnage and tragedy, but Gallio hadn't been an inquisitor for most of the Battle of Barova, and thus, the things he'd seen there would always be with him when he closed his eyes.
"I'll accept the goddess's punishment as it comes, without trying to ease my way out."
He swore to himself he'd never touch the concoction again. In fact, he ought to pour it on the ground. It didn't even work anyway. He reached for it, still frowning. But his hand stopped when his fingertips brushed the brass cylinder. Gallio sighed and left the flask there, knowing full well that he'd drink from it again the next night. This wasn't the first time he'd danced this dance. Disgusted with himself, he unzipped his tent and crawled out, letting the night cool the sweat soaking his shirt. The camp was quiet, the light of the fire in the middle and the torches across its perimeter fighting to keep the absolute darkness of a night without a moon at bay. The Inquisitors slept in individual tents separated from the non-combatants, set up in a line between the forest and the riverbend that protected the campsite's rear. The air was heavy with humidity, and clouds of insects rose from the otherwise quiet, murky waters of the river. Gallio glanced back, squinting through the torchlight, trying to peer into the dark outside. Rivers could be dangerous in Sterevos, where the hidden currents were the least of their secrets. Scaly beasts and other horrors lurked under the waters, invisible to all but the keenest eye, ready to jump out at an unsuspecting traveler and draw them under to their watery doom. Ione and Alvitra had always warned him and the villagers to avoid rivers after dark. It was only common sense. But the Inquisition had their own kind of common sense, and using a river bend to set up camp had tactical advantages that greatly offset the risks. For one, many powerful dark creatures hated running water, including old bloods and dungeon lords, and that alone turned the brown waters into a blessing in disguise. At the camp's center, by the fire, stood one big tent, Master Enric's, overseeing the caravan carts, which were heavy with the loot taken from Uraz's vaults. Next to those were the horses, tired from the day's intense pace toward Constantina, and past them was the stake circle that surrounded the improvised tents that safeguarded the coffin containing the Inquisition's prisoner. An Inquisitor guarded each cart. One Inquisitor glanced at Gallio with sleep-starved eyes. Gallio shrugged with sympathy, still remembering the times when guard duty would fall on him. Gallio headed out the opposite direction, toward the line of trees and past the camp's limits, where the three lookouts guarded the camp from any danger that might come from the forest. Cleric Zeki saluted him lazily as he passed and made no comment. The cleric didn't like Gallio much, and he barely bothered to hide it. The cleric was immersed in the Inquisition's politics, but was too old to climb its ladder, which over time had translated into a bitterness unseemly of a man of his powers. Still, Zeki took his duty as seriously as anyone else. His pair of hawk guardians flew in circles over the camp, two lone golden stars shining above. At the first sight of trouble, the magic hawks would warn the camp about any incoming evil far better than any alarm. Furthermore, Zeki's divine circle of respite protected the area around the camp from black magic's means of incursion. The glow of its runes bathed the cleric in light. The camp was as safe as it could be, not even counting the dozen inquisitors ready to smite their way out of any trouble. And yet Gallio couldn't shake that feeling of danger away. The effects of his nightmare still lingered. He left Cleric Zeki and kept going until he reached the Circle of Respite's outer limit, only a few paces away from the forest line. There, a small fire crackled before a figure sitting on a log. She was covered in a heavy blanket, with a silver-infused longsword resting across her lap, and an ivory bow next to her, along with a quiver full with swan-feathered arrows.
"Up already? You still have a few hours left before your shift,"
Alvitra greeted him as he sat next to her and allowed the fire to seep into his bones.
"Couldn't sleep," he told her. "I don't need much anyway. You'll understand when you're my age."
The former ranger grinned.
"Don't start that dung with me. I've wood elf blood from my mother's side. At your age, I'll be just as fresh as I am today."
She flicked a strand of her cropped hair away from her heart-shaped face. Her ears were indeed slightly pointy, although that could mean nothing. Many Sterevosi claimed to have elven blood somewhere on their family tree. Some believed that the few extra years of youth increased their marriage prospects. For others, it was mere vanity.
"If you say so,"
Gallio told her, returning the grin.
"Anything new in the front lines?"
"Not at all,"
Alvitra said sadly.
"A few overgrown rats and a curious wolf pack that sniffed around before fucking off. Alita's mercy, I almost wish bandits would try their luck on us. The light knows I could use the extra points."
She focused and summoned her character sheet.
"There are so many talents I need to rework my build."
Gallio winced in sympathy. Alvidra's predicament was the reason most Inquisitors began their training from a very young age, as some divine talents turned normal ones redundant, wasting the experience invested in them. It was extremely hard to alter one's character sheet after buying a talent, but the light could do things with its divine experience points that mere mortals couldn't. One such thing was to buy special talents for their favored devotees, which was the reason all new Inquisitors gained the same starting package of Smite and Pledge of the Faithful without paying for them. It was Alita herself who bought the talents, a trivial investment of experience for one such as her. Smite turned Power Attack obsolete. Smite did its job much better, and with the added benefit of royally ruining the day of any dark-aligned creature struck by it. Pledge of the Faithful was a huge catch-all.